Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Young, professional African-Americans measure success by how far up the corporate ladder they've climbed, says Fortune magazine writer Cora Daniels in her new book, Black Power, Inc. Their parents' generation opened doors for them. Now they're gunning for the corner office. Tonight on Point, proclaiming a new base for black power, American business. But first, the Sasser internet worm continues to wreak havoc. Since the worm was discovered Friday, hundreds of thousands of computers have been infected worldwide. At least 10 Fortune 500 companies have been hit by the worm. Finland's largest bank closed 120 of its offices as a precaution. Computer troubles that may have been linked to Sasser grounded flights on Delta Airlines on Saturday. Paul Boudin is contributing writer for Wired magazine. I asked him to describe what's going on with the Sasser worm.
This is a worm like many others that have hit people's computers in recent years. It was released on Friday and has spread fairly quickly, not as bad as some of the previous ones, and is now infecting somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million PCs out there.
How does this worm work?
The Sasser worm sneaks into an open internet port on the Windows operating system that should be used for file sharing, but instead it takes over your computer and basically just then finds more computers to copy itself to. So it can slow down people's computers and clog net traffic.
Does it do damage to your files or to your computer?
Unlike many of the recent viruses, this one seems designed not to do damage. There are some Russian programmers who may or may not be the people who wrote it, and they've said in the past that they're just trying to raise awareness rather than actually cause damage on the internet.
So how does Sasser, the worm, exactly get into a computer? If you're connected to the web, it can come in whether or not you're clicking on attachments in email. Is that right?
This worm spreads without any help from the PC owner. If your PC is connected to the internet and you don't have what's called a firewall set up to block unwanted connections, it will just contact your PC without your knowledge and copy itself over without your knowledge.
Are big users taking emergency measures to try and close the doors against this worm?
I think that most large companies and service providers on the internet have already done what they need to do to block the worm. What matters now is listeners with their own personal computers at home. All they need to know is there is a URL they should go to, Microsoft.com/protect. This is one of the best things Microsoft has done, and yet no one seems to know about it. There are three easy-to-follow automatic steps there. If you had followed them, you would not even know about this worm today.
Is this worm's rapid transmission Microsoft's fault? Has it left open some chink in the armor that this is exploiting?
Microsoft is certainly to blame in a sense that they shipped millions of operating systems which had the internet ports left open for convenience because it made it possible for anyone to buy a computer, turn it on, and then use services in the future later without needing to do any configuration or to even know how it worked. But they've now come around the other way. They've realized that virus writers and hackers are using these openings rather than any actual software that someone would want to run. So they have recently started with Windows XP and with the upgrades to other versions, closing off these openings by default rather than leaving everything wide open on your computer.
Paul, we read that the Northwest Cybercrime Task Force, which is the FBI and other federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies, I guess, around the Microsoft area, is going after this. They're pursuing leads. How do authorities track down the authors of a worm like Sasser?
Tom, from my experience, no virus or worm author has ever been caught unless they were foolish enough to brag about it. Most of them get away with it.
In that case, do we just have to wait like some kind of forest fire for this thing to burn itself out, for everybody to get the Microsoft patch up and running, and eventually Sasser is conquered that way?
Once a virus or a worm is released, there's really no way to go back and trace who launched it. And it is just like a forest fire right now. We have to wait until it burns out everyone who hasn't installed the necessary precautions on their computer.
And we just, I guess, thank our lucky stars this time that it's not actually destructive to your hard drive or anything else. It just passes itself along.
For what it's worth, at least Sasser is not spreading as fast as other viruses and worms have done, and it's not deliberately destroying data. It could have been a lot worse.
Paul Boutin, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
Paul Boutin is contributing writer for Wired Magazine. He spoke with me from San Francisco. African Americans born after the Civil Rights Movement are now signing on to the economics movement, says Fortune magazine writer Cora Daniels in her new book, Black Power, Inc. They're not marching with fists raised for equal rights. They're marching into business meetings with PowerPoint presentations and big ambitions. They're shooting for top positions in the business world and winning. Never mind Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson, says Daniels. This cohort's role models are black business titans. Richard Parsons at Time Warner and Fudge at Young and Rubicam. Ken Chenault at American Express. Tonight on Point, Black Power Incorporated. Is business the new realm of black empowerment? Can a black business elite speak for? Can it lead the country's millions of African Americans? Are you young, black, and in business? Have the doors opened wide? Is the sky the limit? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Cora Daniels, staff writer for Fortune magazine and a contributing writer to Fortune Small Business. Her new book is Black Power, Inc., The New Voice of Success. Good evening and welcome, Cora Daniels.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you, Cora. Thanks for the book and all the insights here. You went out, sat down with a lot of young, emphasis on young, black Americans in business, and have brought back a story. What did you set out to do here, Cora?
I set out to find the stories of the generation after the civil rights movement. I think at the magazine and in life and stuff, we know about the first. We know about the people who broke through the doors. We know about the Dick Parsons, the Ken Chenaults in life. And I wanted to find basically my generation, folks in their 30s and younger who were in the beginnings of their careers and had all the benefits of people knocking through the door and seeing what their goals and aspirations were and how they viewed race and how it played out in the workplace and their careers.
And you specifically went into the business world. You didn't go to Congress.
Right.
You didn't go to, community activists' offices in urban Chicago or New York. Why the business world?
Because I think it's easier to sort of see the goals and ramifications of people in Congress or in the nonprofits and things like that. You know why they're doing what they're doing. I mean, those intentions are pretty obvious. And I think that what's less obvious is folks in the business world. I think a lot of times people just think, oh, they're just trying to make a lot of money, where there really is this race consciousness going on among young black professionals and executives, because they're trying to succeed basically to build black wealth and bring up the race.
I want to look at that. We'll look at a lot of details here, and you've got a lot of fascinating aspects of what's going on in this realm, but I want to make sure I understand what your big claim is, Cora Daniels, for young black business leaders in America, as to their significance to the country, their significance to black Americans. What's your big claim?
My big claim. I think that these young black professionals still feel that they are part of a movement by building black wealth, and they embrace race wholeheartedly. They use their blackness for moving ahead. That's why they want to succeed. They are not afraid to be black and proud in the workplace, which it sometimes catches other generations off guard, because that's not usually the place for that sort of discussion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they sort of expect things to be difficult, and they expect barriers. And instead of trying to break down more doors, they're willing to just pick up and leave and start their own businesses and build wealth that way. I mean, I think one of the most fascinating statistics I came across was that black men between the ages of 25 and 35 with some graduate school experience start businesses more often than any group in the country. So these are folks who, you know, have their MBAs. They have, you know, they're working towards their PhDs. They are already in the best jobs in corporate America. And once they are faced with the same problems that generations before them have, they like, okay, I'll pick up and leave, and I'll build the next Time Warner, basically.
You're drawing a lot of distinctions between this generation and the one before it. But I guess on this big claim front, my question is, are you saying that young Black American business leaders are the heirs to the civil rights leadership, or are they just the beneficiaries of the civil rights era?
I think they're both. I mean, I don't think you can deny that they are beneficiaries. I mean, they wouldn't be able to even barely knock on these doors without what came before them.
Yep.
And I think they're thankful for that. I think that they basically want to go in a little different direction. They don't see, you know, basically we have voting rights. The politics are there. We have elective officials. You know, we can go to the same schools. So the last front to sort of conquer is the economic wealth front, and they are doing it with the same fervency that the civil rights generation and Black Power movements did before. They're doing it saying, we are Black executives, we are succeeding because we are Black, and we are not going to deny race in the company's best companies,
and
the country's best companies.
And their role models, very different. Certainly not Mahatma Gandhi or even Martin Luther King,
right,
or Malcolm X. You're talking about Stan O'Neill, CEO of Merrill Lynch, Franklin Raine,
yeah,
CEO of Fannie Mae, Dick Parsons at Time Warner, Ann Fudge at Young & Rubicam,
right on down
the list.
Yeah, well, this is the world that they're living in. They're going to the best schools. They have the best resumes. They have graduate degrees, and so basically they're in this realm that the civil rights movement fought so hard for them to be in. They're in the best companies, and so they look forward to those folks because they've shot their way up to the top of the corporate ladder. So why not? I mean, one of the most common things that I heard from young folks was that they wanted to be the next Dick Parsons.
That is a very wealthy, very powerful head of Time Warner, a Black,
right,
man astride the corporate world.
Right.
And they're not afraid at all, you say, to be Black. You say the generation before them tried to sort of join the white world. They want to bring, you're saying, this generation, the Blackness front and center right with them.
Well, I think that when you're breaking down the doors and you're the first, you know, the first African American executive at your company and,
yep,
things like that, you're basically trying to prove that you belong and you know, and that you're just as good. And so you're not going to make waves, and that's natural. I'm not trying to criticize that, mm-hmm, generation for that. But you know, the generations afterwards have the advantage of, they don't feel like they have to prove that anymore because a generation already broke down those doors. So they're like, well, you know, I know that I'm just as good. I know that I'm on the same playing field. I went to the same, you know, top 10 college that my coworkers have. So I can come in and be myself.
Let's go. Let's mix it up. The claim that turned my head was this one, Cora Daniels. You say that the mantra with this kind of Black business elite, with their each move up the corporate ladder, is not, will this help me here at this company? But it is, you say, will this help me help Black folks out there? You say this generation's goal is to build the wealth of a people.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds very altruistic for business go-getters. Is that really what these young men and women are up to?
Well, I heard it a lot over and over again, and I think it's because they feel privileged. They know. I mean, they are at the best companies and went to the best schools, but it's not like, you know, a swarm. They might not be the first, but in a lot of meetings, they might still be the only. And so they feel that pressure and they feel that responsibility. And, you know, a lot of times they're at the top. They recognize that they are the elite of a community, basically.
But is that saying that being wealthy themselves is an end in itself because they are, by definition, part of the Black community? Or does it say, I'm going to take this wealth and share it? Or what exactly does it mean?
They basically want to bring others along, and they want to build companies within the Black community and use wealth to gain influence, you know, contribute to political campaigns and use wealth the way that we use wealth for power in this country.
And wealth does get used for power. Cora Daniels is with us tonight. Her new book is Black Power, Inc., The New Voice of Success. We're talking about a new generation of Black leaders emerging not in the church or in politics, but in corporate America's executive suites. Do you buy that America's black business leaders are the country's new black leaders, period? And who has more followers, more clout, Richard Parsons at Time Warner, Ken Chenault at Amex, or Tiger Woods, P. Diddy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about young black go-getters post-civil rights movement pouring themselves into business, not politics. My guest tonight is Cora Daniels. She has written a new book, Black Power, Inc., The New Voice of Success. She's a staff writer for Fortune magazine. You can join our conversation as well. Are you young, black, and in business? Have the doors been open wide? Is the sky now the limit? Does success for a black business elite mean success for black Americans generally? And who do you see as today's most important black leaders? Are they in the boardroom, the corner office? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined also right now by one of the young men profiled in Cora Daniels' new book. His name is Richard Gay. He joins us from New York. He's senior vice president at VH1 and Country Music Television. He's a former partner at the consulting firm Booz Allen Hamilton, where he worked in the firm's global media and entertainment practice, became a partner at a very young age. Good evening and welcome, Richard Gay.
Hi, great. Thank you very much, Tom. And how are you doing, Cora?
Hi.
It's great to have you with us. We're going to hear from you in just a moment, Richard Gay, about your perspective on all this. But Cora Daniels, I wonder if you'd be good enough to introduce Richard Gay and why you chose him as one of the young black business leaders to profile in the book.
Oh, Richard is a perfect example. I mean, he was the youngest black partner at Booz Allen. The consultant industry is anything but diverse, I would say. And I mean, he excelled, and we were just talking about, you know, do young executives basically just want to get wealth for themselves, or is it, are they more altruistic for the community? And I think Richard is a perfect example of this. I mean, he talks freely, openly, and honestly about how he's not just doing this for himself, but he's doing this for people.
Richard Gay, tell us what your experience has been. First of all, if I could ask how old you are, age is, Cora Daniels is very tough in drawing an age line here. You must be in your 30s, I'm guessing, because I'm reading about all these guys and women in their 40s that she said, no way, you're not sufficiently post-civil rights era. How old are you, Richard
Gay? I confess I am 35, Tom.
Okay, so you're right in her sweet spot there. Did you actively see yourself as a post-civil rights kid coming up through school, and when you first came into business, did you have the sense that the doors had been kicked down and all you had to do was work hard and walk through?
Well, I think there's a sense that the doors had been opened by people that, you know, went ahead of me. I don't think that any of us would say that, you know, race doesn't matter anymore. And I actually don't think that's the premise of Cora's book. The
Certainly
fact
not.
Is that it's there. It absolutely matters. But you do realize that there is a chance to overcome it because you have seen people that have broken through those doors already.
So as you have made your really remarkable ascent in the business world, how do you look at it? Elaborate on this for us. You know, let me just put it this way. Are you out for number one? Do you really see yourself as somehow important to the leadership of a larger community, of an African-American community? What's the balance there, Richard Gay?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because I think that really is the challenge that Cora touches on in the book a bit, is that right now there African-Americans can find a way to personal wealth. And one of the issues is, you know, in the civil rights movement, there was a movement that was sweeping the country, and you had to be part of it because people didn't have rights and you needed to be a part of that movement. And today, it quite frankly would be very easy to say, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and take care of my family. I've got a great paying job. I'm going to do extremely well, and that's going to be my personal goal. And I think what Cora has touched on is that there are many of us who feel that, well, make no mistake, I do want to take care of my family and plan to do that, that we feel fortunate to be in the position that we're in and a greater responsibility to try and give something back to the community, whether personally or through the organizations through which we work.
Cora Daniels, I wonder if you're trying to make the case or are making the case that ultimately business successes like Richard Gay are going to open their checkbooks and endow all kinds of black community organizations or you name it with funds, or that simply by achieving success themselves, they are playing a critical role in leadership in the black community.
Well, I don't think you can separate the two. I think that basically we – I think it's very difficult to deny that money brings power in this country. So, you know, whether it's the Richard Gays who succeed and gain that money and what they can do with that money, that's on both fronts. So yes, they bring up the entire Black community by personally doing well, but then they also have a conscience and are trying to build organizations and to fund organizations that already exist and use that wealth and power.
You start the book right off saying anyone who says race doesn't matter is without a doubt lying. In fact, you say that this young generation of Black business leaders is embracing their race more vigorously than even the big successes that came before them, like Stan O'Neill, like Dick mm-hmm. Parsons, and so on. What do you mean exactly by that?
I think that they are very proud to be Black and not shy about letting everyone know that. And you know, especially in the business world, that wasn't always the case. I mean, it wasn't always the case, not just with race, but with gender, with everything. I mean, the business world, usually you succeed by not making waves. And, and sometimes that kind of individuality hasn't been valued. And these folks are going into a very conservative environment. Corporate America is like the most conservative environment, and are proud to say that we are Black executives first, and we want to rise up that ladder so that we can bring other Black faces into these organizations, bring a Black viewpoint into the boardroom, and bring the wealth of these organizations outside to the community.
Richard Gay, I wonder, do you see race as really being that front and center in your business career, your business life and profile? Are you a Black executive first and foremost?
Well, absolutely, because while I, as Cora said, I went to a lot of the good schools that you can think of. You know, I have an MBA from Stanford and went to Wharton undergrad at University of Pennsylvania, and that's all wonderful. But, you know, when people see me initially, the thing that they often react to is the fact that I am an African-American man. And whether I'm a doctor, a lawyer, or a successful businessman, that is how I am often perceived initially. And for me, it's a very important part of my identity and who I am. And to be honest, it did influence the decisions that I made as a business person. You know, when I was at Booz Allen, I chose to serve the media and entertainment sector because it is a very diverse sector. There are people from all walks of life at the kind of top levels of the entertainment industry. And for me, the ability to work in that environment where people have paved the way, where, you know, I wouldn't be the only one in the boardroom or sitting around the table, it was actually a very important part of my decision.
Richard Gay, Cora Daniels, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Scarsdale, New York, Earl G. Graves. He's chairman of Earl G. Graves Limited, which publishes Black Enterprise magazine. He's author of How to Succeed in Business Without Being White. In 2002, Fortune magazine named him one of the most powerful Black executives in the United States. Good evening and welcome, Earl Graves.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Earl Graves, I wonder what you make of the thesis that Cora Daniels has put out there pretty strongly, that there is a new generation of young Black business leaders, that they've got a different view of the world and than their predecessors, including yourself, I guess, and that they are, in a sense, becoming the new leadership of Black America. You've been watching Black men and women in business for a long time. What do you make of the thesis?
Well, first of all, I think that this generation is somewhat different than my generation. My generation was breaking through. We were in the halcyon days of the halcyon days of the Civil Rights Movement. Mm-hmm. And everyone wanted to hire an African-American. General Motors wanted to have the first one or two auto dealerships, and they did, and have done an outstanding job and continue to. They brought Leon Sullivan on their board of directors. I happen to think that there should have been a business person rather than a minister, but he was visible. He was a person who was active in the community nationally, mm-hmm. or communities nationally. And so that was that group. Now you have the group that, Richard, how old are you now?
35.
35, we hear.
Okay, so you're clearly in the group I was talking about, back even a little bit younger. But you have the young people of color. I have a son that's 42, another that's 41, and another that's 37.
Yeah.
And I think that they're active because of what they've seen, seeing me involved in. I think in addition to, obviously, the culture they grew up in, that their mother and I tried to create for them and to expose them to. My sense is that the young African-Americans today did not, I have to explain to some young African Americans that I did have to ride the back of the bus with my second lieutenant's uniform on in the South, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas they only have read about that, if they have read about it. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not going to be sensitive to what's going on, but they just didn't have the exposure to realize what had been accomplished in the last 20 years. Black Enterprise has now been published in almost 35 years.
And is it your sense, Earl Graves, that their experience of advancing in American business is radically different from black men and women in business 20, 25, 30 years ago?
Well, yeah, because 20 and 25 years ago, the jobs were being filled in with personnel jobs. They were people, persons in HR to a great extent, and many major corporations, if you look to see where the African-American executive is, who he or she may be the highest-ranking person, it ends up being the person in HR. Because that was always, quote, the safe job. Now, that doesn't mean that the African-American servant in those positions were not very talented and skilled and intelligent. They were. But it was the job that was kind of, let's put the person over in HR or community affairs or urban affairs, and that's where you found the people in my generation. I mean, that's the reality of it. They also were people who were much more willing to reach out and to do, to assist those of us who were trying to get what we needed to get in terms of our own businesses. In other words, if that person worked at General Motors and was a person that wanted to gain an auto dealership or go into training for being a General Motors dealer, that person, I can think of Darwin Davis as a good friend from the retired as a senior vice president of the Equitable. I think if Darwin Davis had been white, he'd have been chairman of the Equitable. He was the highest performing agent that ever was at Equitable up until the time that he retired.
But do I hear you saying, Earl Graves, that earlier generation was more active in reaching out to other black entrepreneurs, businessmen, strivers?
Yes, all right, yeah, I'm clearly saying that. I said that in my book also.
Cora Daniels, does that square with the claim you're making here for this generation being leaders in the community?
No, I mean, not to take anything away from that generation, but I think that this generation tends to be underestimated. Mm-hmm. And I think that Mr. Graves made a wonderful point that, you know, that he has to remind folks sometimes that, you know, that he had to ride the back of the bus. And I think that's a great distinction, because this is a generation that doesn't have any firsthand memories of the civil rights movement. So it is what they've learned about in books. And that doesn't mean that they're ignorant of it, but it means that their expectations are very high.
No, because the point I'm making is that when they graduate, they don't want to be the black HR person. They know that they train next to white Americans.
Exactly.
Americans who are, and they know they're equally as talented, if not more talented.
Exactly. They want to be the black CEO,
right,
basically.
They don't want to be held back, and that's their goals. Now, along the way, they have to walk a softer track than we walked. I mean, Richard Parsons and I are trustees of Howard University. He is chairman of the development committee for our capital fund drive. I went to Morgan State, but I'm a trustee of Howard now.
Yeah. Right, but that's also
the point
making
I'm making is that he is active. He is having a major event, next week at the new Time Life building, which he can do. He can be visible. He can be involved. But Ken Chinoza could also head up the chairmanship of.
But so are the Richard Gays. And so that's making an assumption that the generation coming after aren't doing that. And they are. And I think that too often the younger generation is not given credit for doing those types of things.
Cordaniels,
and not only are they doing those types of things, but they're also willing to make race an issue in the workplace.
Cordaniels, Richard Gay, Earl Graves, I want to begin to bring some callers in here. They've been patiently waiting for us, if you'd be kind enough to let me. Sheila is calling from Roslindale, Massachusetts. Hi, Sheila. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate here,
picking
up on some of the things Mr. Graves was talking about. I've worked with this generation of young African Americans. I raise money for a major university, or have done, shall I say.
Yep.
And so I've dealt with the Richard Parsons, and I've dealt with, you know, the Ken Chenaults, and I've dealt with this younger group whose names wouldn't mean anything to anybody.
I should say again, just for people who don't know, Ken Chenault, who's head of American Express.
Exactly.
Got it. Yep.
And what I have found to an astonishing degree is, one, the ignorance of history. I mean, when I was working in business development for a hedge fund manager on Wall Street, I had to explain to him what Brown versus Board of Education was,
And you're talking here about this younger generation of business people.
I'm talking about a fellow who is in his mid-30s at
this
point.
Okay.
And there is this, he couldn't believe that, you know, blacks had, and I'm not of the generation who experienced the back of the bus, et cetera, but
right.
I'm close enough to it mm-hmm. and sufficiently historically minded of where I've come from
mm-hmm.
that, you know, this is always in my mind. What I find is that there is an extraordinary sense of entitlement. And I must disagree with Ms. Daniels when I say that her generation did not invent the notion of self-confidence and self-assurance. I've never felt I had to prove anything to anyone except perhaps my parents. And I've gone
where we all bow at that altar.
Ivy League thing also.
Right. So you're not seeing the big
no way
step up as leaders. Cora Daniels, what do you say?
I think this self-entitlement, I think is right on. I think that the expectations are very high. And I think when you feel entitled and the expectations are high, you accept less. And so that's why a lot of these folks are jumping off the corporate ladder or demanding more when they're in these companies. The caller's point on the tragedy of the young 35-year-old who didn't know Brown versus Board of Ed. I mean, there's nothing you can comment to such ignorance. But, you know, I don't think that he represents a generation.
But yeah, we've got that skeptical view. And Sheila, thank you for your call. Richard Gay, I hear you there.
No, I was saying, and that absolutely is the danger in making generalizations, because I think in any generation, you will find people that were successful that want to kind of deny who they are, and you'll find people who were successful and want to embrace who they are. And so you have to be very careful in picking kind of individual instances and trying to make kind of vast generalizations about things.
Sure. Earl Grays, we've just got a minute before the break. I want to ask you how you see business leadership sitting in the overall spectrum of challenges that faces this one community, the African-American community. Can the African-American community look to business leaders as their overall leaders? Is it the right place to look?
I think they can see them as both role models in business and role models in civil rights. You know, you have to understand that when you start talking about a Richard Parsons, who's the chief executive officer of Time Warner, and Ken Chernow, who's the chief executive officer of American Express, and Stan Lee, who's the chief executive officer of Merrill Lynch, their first obligation is to their shareholders. And that's what they have to see first. They're not in that role to be the African-American CEO. You can visibly see that they are. You know who they are. They have not forgotten who they are on any given day. I'm pretty certain about at least the three people I've just mentioned. Tom Jones at, mm-hmm. at Citibank would be another person. But their obligation, first and foremost, when they take on the mantle and recognize and voted to be the chief executive officer and chairman of the board of that company. In most instances, their first responsibility is to their shareholders. And you're not going to have them stand up and say, I'm going to go out and hire 2,000 African-Americans tomorrow morning. They may quietly do it, but they're not going to do that to the detriment of having an insurrection among shareholders because of the fact that many of the shareholders here and one of them make a statement like that might be concerned about it. I have seen The four gentlemen I've mentioned, and I think I'd mention Joyce, what's the woman's name we just went over?
Ann Fudge.
Ann Fudge, sorry. But Joyce Roche was at, I'm thinking her right over at, what was the people that did Pots and Pans?
I don't have that one.
That's a terrible way to describe it. But anyway, she wasn't watching Pots and Pans. She was very high up in the company. I'm doing a blank on the company right now. But
we're going to have to come back after a short break. Earl Graves, Richard Gay, Cora Daniels, please stand by. This is On Point.
We're funded.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new generation of black leaders emerging not in the church or in politics, but in corporate America's executive suites. We're joined tonight by Cora Daniels. She's author of the new book, Black Power, Inc., The New Voice of Success, also from Scarsdale, New York, Earl G. Graves, chairman of Earl G. Graves Limited, publisher of Black Enterprise Magazine, and from New York, Richard Gay, senior vice president at VH1 and Country Music Television. You can join us as well. Is it time for black movers and shakers to move beyond rage, in Cora Daniels' phrase, and into the boardroom? Is business the new realm of black empowerment? Is new black wealth for a few the key to black power for the many? Is this the dream of the civil rights era or something new? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Earl Graves, I know we just have you for a minute more, but is this the dream? Is this what the civil rights era was all about? producing this generation?
Well, it is for these people to move in into jobs that we historically had not held, and to bring other people along. But their primary role as CEOs of major corporations is to raise shareholder value. I want to be very clear about that.
And Richard Gay, let me put that question to you then. Can you be focused on that primary role that Earl Graves points out and still be a real leader for a community of race, not of capital?
I didn't say you couldn't do both.
Okay, got it. Richard Gay, how do you see it?
I absolutely would agree with that. I mean, your number one priority is to make sure that you're doing well in what you're doing on your job, that you're taking care of your family. And if you're not doing those two, you won't be able to make an impact on the African-American community because you won't be in a position of influence very long. So you absolutely have to find a way to do both, and it's very much a personal choice. And, you know, a lot of the men that Earl mentioned earlier are in unbelievable positions of power, and they do some things very publicly and some things very privately, but you can be sure that they absolutely, all of them, do make a difference.
Richard Gay, Earl Graves, thanks to both of you for being with us tonight. It's been great to have you.
Thank you. Let me just make one point and I'll get out.
Yes, sir.
When we will have made progress when myself and Richard and Cora and you cannot name all of the African-American CEOs in this country. That's what we will.
We've got it. Well, it sounds like Richard Gay's generation is determined to make that happen. Earl Graves.
Keep in mind, Chenault and those guys are in their late 40s and early 50s. Yeah. They're not old men like I am. Yeah.
We've got it. Thank you so much for joining us. Earl Graves, publisher of Black Enterprise magazine, Richard Gay, senior VP at VH1 and Country Music Television. Cora Daniels, if you allow me, I'd like to invite into our conversation now Ronald Walters. He's joining us from Silver Spring, Maryland. He's director of the African-American Leadership Institution at the University of Maryland. He's co-author of the book African-American Leadership. Good evening and welcome, Ronald Walters.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us. Help us make sense of this. I'm trying to get my head around Cora Daniels' thesis that this new generation of very feisty, driven, ambitious black business leaders are emerging as the leadership for black America. Do you see it, Ronald Walters? Do you buy it?
Not yet. They're not emerging as the leadership for black America because they don't yet have the opportunities or the status to do that. There is a difference between the two communities. Certainly in the white community, what we've done in our study of African-American leadership is to compare black and white leaders in terms of the structure of our communities.
Mm-hmm.
And in the white community, the business leader is far more prevalent, primarily because they have had the opportunity and they've had the mobility. Mm-hmm. And they are leaders in terms of the question of scale. We have a lot of businesses, but in terms of the scale of those businesses, they don't give us sort of leadership of a community. They give us some status.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the difference. And so when you look at white leadership, they not only are leaders of business, but they use that scale. They use that status and their resources to become leaders in other fields. For example, if you look at the Senate of the United States, many of the people in the Senate are former business leaders.
Sure.
So they've used those resources to transmigrate into other areas.
Exactly.
Cora Daniels, is that your point, that blacks should celebrate the advancements of these business leaders because they will then end up with the resources that can put them in that kind of position?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what the Richard Gays are doing. I mean, these folks they're not at the pinnacle yet. They're not the Dick Parsons yet, but that is the road that they want to go to because they want to exactly what Professor Walters has said. Use that power for influence.
Ronald Walters, I keep thinking in this conversation, we're talking here self-avowedly about a black elite that has studied alongside a white elite at top schools and had lots of opportunities that have come their way. Yet it was just today Senator John Kerry was talking about how in many urban areas you've got a nearly 50% dropout rate in inner cities. Many of these students, certainly not all, but many African-American. What's the relationship between this elite and a large population that has very few of these advantages and opportunities? Can the lines of leadership connect with that larger population?
Well, I think that the lines of leadership can connect. One of the reasons why our leadership structure is as it is, which is to say it's dominated by political leaders and civil rights leaders,
mm-hmm.
Is because of problems like social problems like that. Business leaders, of course, they're not called upon to fix a problem like that. But civil rights and political leaders are called upon to do public policy, to raise the attention of the public to problems like that, and then to try to get the resources to fix them. So that we have so many problems that that leadership has emerged in order to fix those problems. And so that's the reason why those leaders are the leading edge of the leadership structure of our community.
But are you confident that as, again, this younger generation of black go-getters who are doing very well, as Cora Daniels finds, are you confident that once they've, you know, hit the big time and they've got the big house and the big bank account, that they're going to plug in to those issues in the broader black community, or do they just become part of a transracial American elite that's not necessarily concerned about those problems further down the ladder?
Well, there are some troubling signs right now. And as a matter of fact, we do have some blacks in some of the sectors that we have right now who are not in the corporate sector with money. We have blacks in athletics, entertainment.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, my mind goes back to the 1998 election cycle. I was on the board of an organization doing voter turnout. And we were trying to get $5 million for voter turnout that year for the National Black Drive.
Not that much money.
Not a lot of money. That same week, Sean Puffy Combs spent $7 million on a Manhattan penthouse. He could have funded the entire drive for the black community to get out to vote and had $2 million left over. Now, but the only problem, of course, is that people like that who have money, and a lot of them are young in the hip-hop field and in others, don't have the political consciousness to do that.
So the proof is in the pudding, ultimately. Cora Daniels, a stronger urge in that direction from the business community, not sports or entertainment?
I think that's because they see a gap. They definitely, they're not following the footsteps of you know, the civil rights generation in terms of, you know, they're not trying to be civil rights leaders and things like that, because we already have that. And we still have this tremendous gap that you've talked about where, you know, we can have this black elite and we can have, you know, on my block, all these single mothers.
So are you saying there's a gap? There's nothing I can do about it, so I'll keep my $7 million in the condo?
No. I'm saying that there's a gap, and so that's why they're trying to conquer the business world, because we've already made inroads into the political world and in the social world and things like that. So they're trying to conquer the business world, and use that wealth for, you know, to bridge that gap. And I don't think that you could sort of put them in the same category as entertainment and athletes and things like that.
These are
what you said. They're very well educated business elite, and this is how they've chosen to sort of become leaders, is by excelling in the business world.
Right. I hear Ronald Walter saying it's too early to tell if they're going to fill that gap, build that bridge. I want to turn to our callers again. Mike is calling from Wilmington, North Carolina. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. Thanks, Mike. What's on your mind, my friend?
Yeah, I'm pretty much in the middle. I'm 47 years old, so I can remember the civil rights era in the 60s. And some of the things that Mr. Graves talked about, I can really relate to. But also, I'm in the financial services field, and I am an entrepreneur, and I can relate to what the young lady is talking about, but that those numbers, like the earlier numbers with Mr. Graves, they are small numbers, but, of course, they're continuing to grow. Many of the African-Americans who are in that age group that she's in, they are confident, they are bolder, they are cockier. They know that they can do the job, and they want more. But they don't want to settle for what their parents settle for, because they believe that they can have it all.
Are you suggesting there, Mike, that the black community sort of found the limits of what the civil rights movement could bring it, and then it had to turn to business to go the rest of the distance?
Well, a lot of this stuff's not taught in the church. And I was thinking about that today, and I heard the show, and I just had to get on it. So this stuff's not taught in the church. But we are benefiting from the civil rights movement, and many of the African Americans know that companies want African Americans. I know some young folks who are in higher spots in their businesses because these corporations know that African Americans have a lot of buying power, and the face of an African American there is a sign to say that we think times are changing.
Mike, thanks very much for your call. Ronald Walters, how about the notion that the more pegs you can put very high up the sort of wall of the American economy, the more black pegs you can put up there, somehow the better overall for the black community, that there's a, it just naturally helps. What's your level of confidence in that?
Well, I think we need a sea change in some things. It's enough to have, I think, individual confidence. And I'm obviously sure that we do that, have that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for 24 years, I was at Howard University and in the middle of the African-American community. And I taught these kids every day. And I watched them grow. I have a brother who came out of Howard University's business school. I have another one who had an MBA from Howard's business school.
Mm-hmm.
What we are not teaching and urging young people to do, even I find that at places like Harvard, really is to become the head of and create the IT&Ts and the AT&Ts and the Ford Motor Companies. We are all too, I think, satisfied to have people go to work for one of these companies and be satisfied with the fact that they have some status in somebody else's company. We are not going, I think, as a community, to become the kind of leaders we need to be with that paradigm. And yet, that is a paradigm that we have not yet broken from.
Corey Daniels, I hear you saying something a little different on that front, that in fact, that's exactly where this new generation is
no,
pushing
it is.
Forward.
It is. I mean, entrepreneurship is, I mean, every single person in corporate America that I talk to of this young group, their ultimate goal was to start a business. I mean, I had already mentioned that statistic of a, you know, black men between the ages of 25 and 35 years old with some graduate school experience start businesses more than any other group in the country. I mean, African Americans are 50% more likely to start businesses than their white counterparts. This is the goal. They're going to these companies so they can learn the best way to do things so then they can start their own.
But, you know, the problem with that, of course, is that we have, 800,000. We have a lot of businesses.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the number of employees, there's something like 1.2 average employees.
Right.
So what we don't have, I think, yet, it's all well and good for an individual to start a business. I could go out and do that today.
Mm-hmm.
Paper business, and a lot of them are paper businesses. What I'm talking about is the kind of business that brings about development and real entrepreneurship and real levels of the possibilities of hiring.
Well,
and
I think never
real
before.
Kind of economic activity that one sees in this country that really changes things.
Well, I think Earl Grey had mentioned it before that there's a difference between the wave of black executives now than a generation before, because before, basically, if you were a black face in corporate America, you were in HR or urban affairs or something like that, and now you have the Richard Gays who are you know, movers and shakers within the company and control, profit and loss lines in these businesses.
Yeah,
and
so we have too few of those.
But that's who this generation is. So when they leave and start their businesses, that's the experience they're bringing with them.
Well, I would hope that they do what their white counterparts do, and really increasingly what many immigrants are doing when they come to the United States, which is to say, come out of this individualistic paradigm and put these businesses together, pool their resources mm-hmm. together so that the kind of scale, the economies of scale that they're able to achieve are far greater than we have right now.
Well, with that, we're going to have to close it tonight, but you've opened a big picture for us. Ronald Walters, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Good to be with you.
Ronald Walters, director of the African American Leadership Institution at the University of Maryland, and Cora Daniels, author of Black Power, Inc., The New Voice of Success. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University.